then, do you think you should?
Yes, dearling. I filled my glass.
Why can't you turn the cards blindfolded?
They have to be read.
Well, how would it be if Mary turned them, or I did, and you read them?
There's supposed to be a closeness between the reader and the cards, but I don't know. We could try.
Mary said, I think if we do it at all, we ought to do it the right way.
She's always that way. She doesn't like change. Little change, I mean. The big ones she can handle better than anyone. Blows up at a cut finger, but would be calm and efficient with a cut throat. I had a throb of unease because I'd told Mary we discussed this, and here we were seeming to think of it for the first time.
We talked about it this morning.
Yes, when I came in for coffee. I've been thinking about it all day. I brought the cards.
It is Mary's tendency to confuse intentness with anger, and anger with violence, and she is terrified of violence. Some drinking uncles put that fear on her, and it's a shame. I could feel her fear rising.
Let's not fool with it, I said. Let's play some casino instead.
Margie saw the tactic, knew it, had probably used it.
All right with me.
My fortune's set. I'm going to be rich. Let it go at that.
You see, I told you he didn't believe it. He leads you all around the bush, and then he won't play. He makes me so mad sometimes.
I do? You never show it. You're always my darling wife. Isn't it strange how sometimes you can feel currents and cross-currents? Not always, but sometimes. Mary doesn't use her mind for organized thought, and maybe this makes her more receptive of impressions. A tension was growing in the room. It crossed my mind that she might not be best friends with Margie anymore, might never feel easy with her.
I'd really like to know about the cards, I said. I'm ignorant. I always heard that gypsies do it.
Are you a gypsy?
I don't think I ever knew one.
Mary said, her maiden name was Russian, but she's from Alaska.
Then that accounted for the wide cheekbones.
Margie said, I have a guilty secret I've never told you, Mary, how we came to be in Alaska.
The Russians owned it, I said. We bought it from them.
Yes, but did you know it was a prison, like Siberia, only for worse crimes?
What kind of crimes?
The worst. My great-grandmother was sentenced to Alaska for witchcraft.
What did she do?
She raised storms.
I laughed. I see you come by it naturally.
Raising storms?
Reading cards, same thing, maybe.
Mary said, you're joking, that isn't true.
Well, it may be joking, Mary, but it's true.
That was the worst crime, worse than murder. I've still got her papers, only of course they're in Russian.
Can you speak Russian?
Only a little now.
I said, maybe witchcraft still is the worst crime.
See what I mean, said Mary. He jumps this side and that side. You never know what he's thinking. Last night he got up before daylight this morning, went for a walk.
I'm a scoundrel, I said, an unmitigated, unredeemable rascal.
Well, I'd like to see Margie turn the cards, but her own way, without you mixing in. If we keep talking, the children will be home, and then we can't.
Excuse me a moment, I said. I climbed the stairs to our bedroom. The sword was on the bed, and the hat box open on the floor. I went to the bathroom and flushed the toilet. You can hear the water rushing all over the house. I wet a cloth in cold water and pressed it against my forehead, and particularly against my eyes. They seemed to bulge from inside pressure. The cold water felt good. I sat on the toilet seat and put my face down against the damp washcloth, and when it warmed up, I wet it again. Going through the bedroom, I picked the plumed Knight Templar's hat from its box and marched down the stairs wearing it.
Oh, you fool, said Mary, and she looked glad and relieved.
The ache went out of the air. Can they bleach ostrich feathers? I asked.
It's turned yellow. I think so. Ask Mr. Schultz. I'll take it down Monday.
I wish Margie would turn the cards, said Mary. I would dearly love that.
I put the hat on the newel post of the banister, and it looked like a drunken admiral, if there is such a thing.
Get the card table, Eth. It takes lots of room.
I brought it from the hall closet and snapped the legs open.
Margie likes a straight chair.
I set a dining chair. Do we have to do anything?
Concentrate, said Margie.
On what?
As near as possible on nothing. The cards are in my purse over on the couch.
I'd always thought of fortune-telling cards as greasy and thick and bent. But these were clean and shining, as though they were coated with plastic. They were longer and narrower than playing cards, and many more than 52. Margie sat straight at the table and fanned them. Bright colored pictures and intricate suits. The names were in French.
L'Empereur, L'Ermite, L'Echereau, La Justice, Le Mât, Le Diable.
Earth, sun, moon, and stars, and suits of swords, cups, batons, and money. I guess, if Dunier means money. But the symbol was shaped like a heraldic rose. And each suit with its roi, reine, and chevalier. Then I saw strange cards, disturbing cards. A tower riven by lightning. A wheel of fortune. A man hanging by his feet from a gallows, called
Le Pendu,
and Death, Le Mort, a skeleton with a scythe. Kind of gloomy, I said. Do the pictures mean what they seem to?
It's how they fall in relation. If they fall upside down, they reverse their meaning.
Is there a variation in meaning?
Yes, that's the interpretation.
The moment she had the cards, Margie became formal. Under the lights, her hands showed what I'd seen before, that she was older than she looked. "Where did you learn it?" I asked.
"I used to watch my grandmother and later took it up as a trick for parties. I suppose a way of getting attention."
"Do you believe in it?"
"I don't know. Sometimes remarkable things come out. I don't know."
Could the cards be a concentration ritual, psychic exercise?
Sometimes I think that's true. When I find I give a value to a card it didn't have before, that's when it is usually accurate.
Her hands were like living things as they shuffled and cut and shuffled and cut again, and passed them to me to cut.
"Who am I doing?" "Read Ethan," Mary cried. "See if it matches yesterday's."
Margie looked at me.
"Light hair," she said, "blue eyes. Are you under 40?
"Just."
"The King of Batons."
She found it in the deck.
"This is you."
A picture of a crowned and robed king holding a huge red and blue scepter and Roi de Baton printed under him. She laid it out face up and reshuffled the deck. Then she turned the cards rapidly, speaking in a sing-songy voice as she did. A card on top of my card.
"This covers you."
Crosswise on top.
"This crosses you."
One above.
"This crowns you."
One below.
"This is your foundation. This before, this behind you."
She had formed a cross of cards on the table. Then rapidly she turned up four in a line to the left of the cross, saying,
"Yourself, your house, your hopes, your future."
The last card was the man hanging upside down,
Le Pendu.
But from where I sat across the table, he was right side up. "So much for my future."
"It can mean salvation," she said.
Her forefinger traced the line of her lower lip. Mary demanded,
"Is the money there?"
"Yes, it's there," she said absently.
And suddenly she gathered the cards, shuffled them over and over, and laid them out again, muttering her ritual under her breath. She didn't seem to study individual cards, but to see the whole group at once, and her eyes were misty and remote. A good trick, I thought, a killer at ladies' clubs, or anywhere else. So must the pythoness have looked, cool and composed and confusing. If you can hold people tense, hardly breathing, expectant for a long time, they'll believe anything. Not acting so much as technique, timing. This woman was wasting her talents on traveling salesmen. But what did she want of us, or of me? Suddenly she gathered the cards, patted them square, and put them in the red box, which said, "I, Muller, et compagnie, fabrique des cas." "Can't do it," she said. "Happens sometimes." Mary said breathlessly, "Did you see something you didn't want to tell?" "Oh, I'll tell all right. Once when I was a little girl, I saw a snake change its skin, a Rocky Mountain rattler. I watched the whole thing. Well, looking at the cards, they disappeared, and I saw that snake changing its skin, part dusty and ragged and part fresh and new. You figure it out." I said, "Sounds like a trance state. Ever happened before?"
"Three times before."
"Make any sense the other times?"
"Not that I know of."
"Always the snake?"
"Oh, no. Other things, but just as crazy."
Mary said enthusiastically,
"Maybe it's a symbol of the change in fortune that's coming to Ethan."
"Is he a rattlesnake?"
"Oh, I see what you mean."
"Makes me feel crawly," Margie said. "Once I kind of liked snakes, and then when I grew up I hated them. They give me the willies. I better be going. Ethan can see you home. Wouldn't think of it."
"I'd be glad to."
Margie smiled at Mary.
"You keep him right here with you," she said. "You don't know what it's like to be without one."
"Nonsense," said Mary. "You could get a husband by crooking your finger."
"That's what I did before. It's no good. If they come that easy, they're not worth having. Keep him home. Someone might grab him."
She got into her coat as she talked. A fast scrammer.
"Lovely dinner. I hope you'll ask me back. Sorry about the fortune, Ethan."
"Will we see you in church tomorrow?"
"No, I'm going up to Montauk tonight."
"But it's too cold and wet. I love the mornings on the sea up there. Good night." She was out before I could even hold the door for her. Out as though something was after her. Mary said, "I didn't know she was going up there tonight." And I couldn't tell her, neither did she.
"Ethan, what do you make of that fortune tonight?"
"She didn't tell one."
"You forget, she said there would be money."
"But what do you make of it?" "I think she saw something she didn't want to tell. Something that scared her."
"Maybe she once saw the snake and it stayed in her mind."
"You don't think it had a meaning?"
"Honey roll, you're the fortune expert. How should I know?"
"Well, anyway, I'm glad you don't hate her. I thought you did."
"I'm tricky," I said. "I conceal my thoughts."
"Not from me, you don't." "They'll stay right through the second show."
"Come again?"
"The children. They always do. I thought you were wonderful about the dishes."
"I'm devious," I said, "and in due course, I have designs on your honor."
Chapter 6. It has been my experience to put aside a decision for future pondering. Then one day, fencing a piece of time to face the problem, I found it already completed, solved, and the verdict taken. This must happen to everyone, but I have no way of knowing that. It's as though, in the dark and desolate caves of the mind, a faceless jury has met and decided. This secret and sleepless area in me I've always thought of as black, deep, waveless water, a spawning place from which only a few forms ever rise to the surface. Or maybe it's a great library where is recorded everything that has ever happened to living matter back to the first moment when it began to live. I think some people have closer access to this place than others. Poets, for example. Once, when I had a paper route and no alarm clock, I worked out a way to send a signal and to get a reply. Lying in bed at night, I would see myself standing on the edge of the black water. I pictured a white stone held in my hand, a circular stone. I would write on its surface in very black letters, 4 o'clock, then drop the stone and watch it sink, turning over and over until it disappeared. It worked for me. On the 2nd of 4, I awakened. Later I could use it to rouse me at 4:10 or 4:15, and it never failed me. And then sometimes a strange, sometimes hideous thing thrusts up to the surface as though a sea serpent or a kraken emerged from the great depths. Only a year ago, Mary's brother Dennis died in our house, died dreadfully, of an infection of the thyroid that forced the juices of fear through him so that he was violent and terrified and fierce. His kindly Irish horse face grew bestial. I helped to hold him down, to pacify and reassure him in his death dreaming, and it went on for a week before his lungs began to fill. I didn't want Mary to see him die. She had never seen death, and this one, I knew, might wipe out her sweet memory of a kindly man who was her brother. Then, as I sat waiting by his bed, a monster swam up out of my dark water. I hated him. I wanted to kill him, to bite out his throat. My jaw muscles tightened, and I think my lips fleered back like a wolf's at the kill. When it was over, in panic guilt, I confessed what I had felt to old Doc Peel, who signed the death certificate. "I don't think it's unusual," he said. "I've seen it on people's faces, but few admit it." "But what causes it? I liked him." "Maybe an old memory," he said. "Maybe a return to the time of the pack when a sick or hurt member was a danger. Some animals and most fish tear down and eat a weakened brother." "But I'm not an animal, or a fish." "No, you're not. And perhaps that's why you find it foreign. But it's there. It's all there." "He's a good old man, Doc Peel, a tired old man. He's birthed and buried us for 50 years. Back to that Congress in the dark. It must have been working overtime. Sometimes a man seems to reverse himself, so that you would say, "He can't do that. It's out of character." Maybe it's not. It could be just another angle. Or it might be that the pressures above or below have changed his shape. You see it in war a lot. A coward turning hero, and a brave man crashing in flames. Or you read in the morning paper about a nice, kind family man who cuts down wife and children with an axe. I think I believe that a man is changing all the time. But there are certain moments when the change becomes noticeable. If I wanted to dig deep enough, I could probably trace the seeds of my change right back to my birth or before. Recently, many little things had begun to form a pattern of larger things. It's as though events and experiences nudged and jostled me in a direction contrary to my normal one, or the one that I'd come to think was normal. The direction of the grocery clerk, the failure, the man without real hope or drive, barred in by responsibilities for filling the bellies and clothing the bodies of his family, caged by habits and attitudes I thought of as being moral, even virtuous. It may be that I had a smugness about being what I called a good man. And surely I knew what was going on around me. Marullo didn't have to tell me. You can't live in a town the size of New Baytown and not know. I didn't think about it much. Judge Dorcas fixed traffic tickets for favors.
It wasn't even secret. And favors call for favors. The town manager, who was also Bud Building Supplies, sold equipment to the township at a high price, and some of it not needed. If a new paved street went in, it usually turned out that Mr. Baker and Marullo and half a dozen other business leaders had bought up the lots before the plan was announced. These were just facts of nature, but I had always believed they weren't facts of my nature. Marullo and Mr. Baker and the drummer and Margie Young Hunt and Joey Morphy in a concentration had been nudging me, and altogether it amounted to a push, so that I've got to put aside a little time to think it out. My darling was purring in her sleep, with the archaic smile on her lips, and she had the extra glow of comfort and solace she gets after love. A calm fulfilledness. I should have been sleepy after wandering around the night before, but I wasn't. I've noticed that I'm rarely sleepy if I know I can sleep long in the morning. The red dots were swimming on my eyes, and the street light threw the shadows of naked elm branches on the ceiling, where they made slow and stately cat's cradles, because the spring wind was blowing. The window was open halfway, and the white curtains swelled and filled like sails on an anchored boat. Mary must have white curtains, and often washed. They give her a sense of decency and security. She pretends a little anger when I tell her it's her lace-curtain Irish soul. I felt good and fulfilled, too, but whereas Mary dives for sleep, I didn't want to go to sleep. I wanted to go on fully tasting how good I felt. I wanted to think about the I Love America essay contest my offspring were entering. But behind these and others, I wanted to consider what was happening to me and what to do about it. So naturally I got out the last thing first and found that the dark jury of the deep had already decided for me. There it was, laid out and certain. It was like training for a race and preparing and finally being down at start with your spikes set in their holes. No choice then. You go when the pistol cracks. I found I was ready with my spikes set, waiting only for the shot. And apparently, I was the last to know. All day, people had remarked that I looked well. By that meaning, I looked different, more confident, changed. That drummer had a look of shock in the afternoon. Marullo had inspected me uneasily. And Joey Boy felt the need to apologize for something I had done. Then Margie Young Hunt. Maybe she was the sharpest with her rattlesnake dream. Some way she had penetrated and discovered a certainty about me before I was certain of it. And the symbol was a rattlesnake. I found I was grinning in the dark. And afterward, confused, she used the oldest trick, the threat of infidelity, a bait cast in a flowing tide to find what fish are feeding there. I didn't remember the secret whisper of her hidden body. No, the picture was of her clawed hands that showed age and nervousness and the cruelty that comes to one when control of a situation is lost. Sometimes I wish I knew the nature of night thoughts. They're close kin to dreams. Sometimes I can direct them, and other times they take their head and come rushing over me like strong, unmanaged horses. Danny Taylor came in. I didn't want to think about him and be sad, but he came anyway. I had to use a trick a tough old sergeant taught me once, and it works. There was a day and a night and a day in the war that was all one piece, one unit of which, the parts, were just about all the dirty dreadfulness that can happen in that sick business. While it was going on, I'm not sure I knew its agony, because I was busy and unutterably tired. But afterward, that unit of a day and a night and a day came back to me over and over again in my night thoughts, until it was like that insanity they call battle fatigue, and once named shell shock. I used every trick I could not to think of it, but it crept back in spite of me. It waded through the day to get at me in the dark. Once, mawkish with whiskey,
I told it to my top sergeant, an old pro who had been in wars we've forgotten ever happened. If he'd worn his ribbons, there'd have been no room for buttons. Mike Pulaski, a Polak from Chicago, no relation to the hero. By good fortune, he was decently drunk, or he might have clammed up out of a conditioned conviction about fraternizing with an officer. Mike heard me out, staring at a spot between my eyes.
"Yeah," he said. "I know about that. Trouble is, a guy tries to shove it out of his head. That don't work. What you gotta do is kinda welcome it."
"Well, how do you mean, Mike?"
"Take it something kinda long. You start at the beginning and remember everything you can, right to the end. Every time it comes back, you do that, from the first right through the finish. Pretty soon, it'll get tired and pieces of it will go, and before long, the whole thing will go."
I tried it and it worked. I don't know whether the head shrinkers know about this, but they should. When Danny Taylor came into my night, I gave him Sergeant Mike's treatment. When we were kids together, same age, same size, same weight, we used to go to the grain and feed store on High Street to get on the scales. One week I'd be half a pound heavier, and the next Danny would catch up with me. We used to fish and hunt and swim together, and go out with the same girls. Danny's family was well fixed, like most of the old families of New Baytown. The Taylor's house was that white one with the tall fluted columns on Porlock Street. Once the Taylors had a country house, too, about 3 miles from town. The country all around us is rolling hills, covered with trees, some scrub pine and some with second-growth oak, and hickory and some cedars. Once, long before I was born, the oaks were monsters, so big that the local-built ships had cut their keels and ribs and planking within a short distance of the shipyards until it was all gone. In this roly-poly country, the Taylors once had a house set in the middle of a big meadow, the only level place for miles around. It must once have been a lake bottom, because it was flat as a table and surrounded by low hills. Maybe 60 years ago, the Taylor house burned down and was never rebuilt. As kids, Danny and I used to ride out there on bicycles. We played in the stone cellar and built a hunting lodge of bricks from the old foundation. The gardens must have been wonderful. We could see avenues of trees and a suggestion of formal hedges and borders among the scrabble of the returned forest. Here and there would be a stretch of stone balustrade, and once we found a bust of Pan on a tapering stand. It had fallen on its face and buried its horns and beard in the sandy loam. We stood it up and cleaned it and celebrated it for a time, but greed and girls got the better of us. We finally carted it into Floodhampton and sold it to a junk man for $5. It must have been a good piece, maybe an old one. Danny and I were friends, as all boys must have friends. Then his appointment to the Naval Academy came through. I saw him once in uniform, and not again for years. New Baytown was and is a tight, close-made town. Everyone knew Danny was expelled, and no one discussed it. Taylor's died out. Well, just as Hawley's died out. I'm the only one left, and, of course, Alan, my son. Danny didn't come back until they were all dead, and he came back a drunk. At first I tried to help, but he didn't want me. He didn't want anybody. But, in spite of it, we were close. Very close. I went over everything I could remember, right up to that very morning when I gave him the dollar to let him find his local oblivion. The structure of my change was feeling. Pressures from without. Mary's wish. Alan's desires. Ellen's anger. Mr. Baker's help. Only at the last, when the move is mounted and prepared, does thought place a roof on the building, and bring in words to explain and to justify.
Suppose my humble and interminable clerkship was not virtue at all, but a moral laziness. For any success, boldness is required. Perhaps I was simply timid, fearful of consequences. In a word, lazy. Successful business in our town is not complicated or obscure, and it is not widely successful either, because its practicers have set artificial limits for their activities. Their crimes are little crimes, and so their success is small success. If the town government and the business complex of New Baytown were ever deeply investigated, it would be found that 100 legal and 1,000 moral rules were broken. But they were small violations, petty larceny. They abolished part of the Decalogue and kept the rest. And when one of our successful men had what he needed or wanted, he resumed his virtue as easily as changing his shirt, and for all one could see, he took no hurt from his derelictions, always assuming that he didn't get caught. Did any of them think about this? I don't know. And if small crimes could be condoned by self, why not a quick, harsh, brave one? Is murder by slow, steady pressure any less murder than a quick and merciful knife thrust? I don't feel guilt for the German lives I took. Suppose for a limited time I abolish all the rules, not just some of them. Once the objective was reached, could they not all be resumed? There's no doubt that business is a kind of war. Why not, then, make it all-out war in pursuit of peace? Mr. Baker and his friends did not shoot my father, but they advised him, and when his structure collapsed, they inherited. And isn't that a kind of murder? Have any of the great fortunes we admire been put together without ruthlessness? I can't think of any. And if I put the rules aside for a time, I knew I would wear scars, but would they be worse than the scars of failure I was wearing? To be alive at all is to have scars. All this wondering was the weather vane on top of the building of unrest and of discontent. It could be done because it had been done. But if I opened up that door, could I ever get it closed again? I did not know. I could not know until I had opened it. Did Mr. Baker know? Had Mr. Baker even thought of it? Old Captain thought the Bakers burned the Belvedere for the insurance. Could that and my father's misfortune be the reason Mr. Baker wanted to help me? Were these his scars? What was happening could be described as a great ship being turned and bunted and shoved about and pulled around by many small tugs. Once turned by tide and tugs, it must set a new course and start its engines turning. On the bridge, which is the planning center, the question must be asked, all right? I know now where I want to go. How do I get there? And where are lurking rocks? And what will the weather be? One fatal reef I knew was talk. So many betray themselves before they are betrayed, with a kind of wistful hunger for glory, even the glory of punishment. Anderson's Well is the only confidant to trust. Anderson's Well. I called out to old Captain. Shall I set the course, sir? Is it a good course? Will it get me there? And for the first time he denied me his command. You'll have to work it out yourself. What's good for one is bad for another, and you won't know till after. The old bastard might have helped me then, but perhaps it wouldn't have made any difference. No one wants advice. Only corroboration. Chapter 7. When I awakened, old Sleepy Mary was up and gone, and coffee and bacon were afoot. I could smell them. And you'd have to search for a better day for a resurrection, a green and blue and yellow day. From the bedroom window I could see that everything was resurrecting. Grass, trees. They chose a proper season for it. I put on my Christmas dressing gown and my birthday slippers. In the bathroom I found some of Alan's hair goo and slicked it on so that my combed and brushed scalp felt tight like a cap. Easter Sunday breakfast is an orgy of eggs and pancakes and bacon curling about everything. I crept up on Mary and patted her silk-covered fanny and said, "Kyrie eleison."
"Oh," she said, "I didn't hear you coming."
She regarded my dressing gown, paisley pattern.
"Nice," she said.
"You don't wear it enough."
"I haven't time. I haven't had time."
"Well, it's nice," she said.
"Ought to be. You picked it."
"Are the kids sleeping through these wonderful smells?"
"Oh, no, they're out back, hiding eggs. I wonder what Mr. Baker wants."
The quick jump never fails to startle me. "Mr. Baker, Mr. Baker."
"Oh, he probably wants to help me start my fortune."
"Did you tell him about the cards?"
"Of course not, darling, but maybe he guessed."
Then I said seriously, "Look, Cheesecake, you do think I have a great business brain, don't you?"
"What do you mean?"
She had a pancake up for turning, and it stayed up. "Mr. Baker thinks I should invest your brother's legacy."
"Well, if Mr. Baker—"
"Now wait. I don't want to do it. That's your money and your safety."
"Doesn't Mr. Baker know more about that than you do, dear?"
"I'm not sure. All I know is my father thought he knew. That's why I'm working for Marullo."
"Still, I think Mr. Baker—"
"Will you be guided by me, sweetheart?"
"Well, of course,
in everything."
"Are you being silly?"
"I'm dead serious. Dead."
"I believe you are, but you can't go around doubting Mr. Baker. Why,
he's Mr. Baker. We'll listen to what he has to say, and then—" "I still will want that money right in the bank where it is." Alan shot through the back door as though fired by a slingshot.
"Marullo," he said. "Mr. Marullo's outside. He wants to see you."
"Now what?" Mary demanded. "Well, ask him in."
"I did. He wants to see you outside."
"Ethan, what is it? You can't go out in your robe. It's Easter Sunday." "Alan," I said, "you tell Marullo I'm not dressed. Tell him he can come back later. But if he's in a hurry, he can come to the front door if he wants to see me alone." He dashed. "I don't know what he wants. Maybe the store's been robbed."
Alan shot back, "He's going around front." "Now, dear, don't let him spoil your breakfast. You hear me?"
I went through the house and opened the front door. Marullo was on the porch, dressed in his best for Easter Mass, and his best was black broadcloth and big gold watch chain. He held his black hat in his hand, and he smiled at me nervously, like a dog out of bounds. "Come in."
"No," he said. "I just got one word to say. I heard how that fella offered you kickback."
"Yes?"
"I heard how you threw him out."
"Who told you?"
"I can't tell."
He smiled again. "Well, what about it? You trying to say I should have taken it?" He stepped forward and shook my hand, pumped it up and down twice, very formally.
"You're a good fella," he said.
Maybe he didn't offer enough.
"You kidding? You're a good fella. That's all. You're a good fella."
He reached in his bulging side pocket and brought out a bag.
"You take this."
He patted my shoulder, and then in a welter of embarrassment turned and fled. His short legs pumped him away, and his fat neck flamed where it bulged over his stiff white collar.
"What was it?"
I looked in the bag. Colored candy Easter eggs. We had a big square glass jar of them at the store.
He brought a present for the kids, I said.
Marullo? Brought a present? I can't believe it.
Well, he did.
Why? He never did anything like that.
I guess he just plain loves me.
Is there something I don't know?
Duck Blossom, there are 8 million things none of us know.
The children were staring in from the open back door. I held out the bag to them.
A present from an admirer. Don't get into them until after breakfast.
As we were getting dressed for church, Mary said, I wish I knew what that was all about.
Marullo?
I'll have to admit, darling, I wish I knew what it was all about, too. But a bag of cheap candy.
Do you suppose it might be a grave simplicity?
I don't understand.
His wife is dead. He has neither chick nor child. He's getting old. Maybe, well, maybe he's lonely.
He never's been here before. While he's lonesome, you should ask him for a raise. He doesn't drop in on Mr. Baker. It makes me nervous.
I gauded myself like the flowers of the field. Decent dark suit. My bearing black. Shirt and collar so starchly white they threw the sun's light back in the sun's face. Cerulean tie with cautious polka dots.
Was Mrs. Margie Young Hunt womping up ancestral storms? Where did Marullo get his information? It could only be Mr. Bugger to Mrs. Young Hunt to Mr. Marullo. I do not trust thee, Margie Young, the reason why I cannot tongue. But this I know, and no right sprung, I do not trust thee, Mrs. Young. And with that singing in my head, I delved in the garden for a white flower for my Easter buttonhole. In the angle made by the foundation and the sloping cellar door, there is a protected place, the earth warmed by the furnace and exposed to every scrap of winter sunlight. There, white violets grow, brought from the cemetery where they grow wild over the graves of my ancestors. I picked 3 tiny, lion-faced blossoms for my buttonhole, and gathered around 12 for my darling, set their own pale leaves about them for a nosegay, and bound them tight with a bit of aluminum foil from the kitchen.
"Why, they're lovely," Mary said. "Wait till I get a pin. I'll wear them."
"They're the first, the very first, my creamy fowl. I am your slave. Christ is risen. All's right with the world."
"Please don't be silly about sacred things, dear.
What in the world have you done with your hair?
Do you like it?"
"I love it. Always wear it that way."
"I wasn't sure you'd like it. Margie said you'd never notice. Wait till I tell her you did."
She set a bowl of flowers on her head, the yearly vernal offering to Aostra.
"Like it?"
"I love it." Now the young got their inspection. Ears, nostrils, shoeshines, every detail, and they resisted every moment of it. Alan's hair was so plastered that he could hardly blink. The heels of his shoes were unpolished, but with infinite care he had trained a line of hair to roll on his crested brow like a summer wave. Ellen was girl of girlness. All in sight was in order. I tried my luck again. "Ellen," I said, "you're doing something different with your hair. It becomes you. Mary, darling, don't you like it?"
"Oh, she's beginning to take pride," Mary said.
We formed a procession down our path to Elm Street, then left to Porlock, where our church is, our old white-steepled church, stolen intact from Christopher Wren. And we were part of a growing stream, and every woman in passing had delight of other women's hats. "I have designed an Easter hat," I said. "A simple, off-the-face crown of thorns in gold, with real ruby droplets on the forehead."
"Ethan," said Mary sternly, "suppose someone should hear you."
"No, I guess it couldn't be popular."
"I think you're horrid,"
Mary said, and so did I, worse than horrid. But I did wonder how Mr. Baker would respond to comment on his hair. Our family rivulet joined other streams, and passed stately greetings, and the stream was a river pouring into St. Thomas Episcopal Church, a medium-high church,
maybe a little higher than center. When the time comes that I must impart the mysteries of life to my son, which I have no doubt he knows, I must remember to inform him about hair. Armed with a kindly word for hair, he will go as far as his concupiscent little heart desires. I must warn him, however, he may kick, beat, drop, tousle, or bump them, but he must never, never mess their hair. With this knowledge, he can be king. The bakers were just ahead of us going up the steps, and we passed decorous greetings.
I believe we're seeing you at tea.
Yes, indeed. Very happy Easter to you.
Can that be Alan? How he's grown. And Mary Ellen. Well, I can't keep track. They shoot up so.
There's something very dear about a church you grew in. I know every secret corner, secret odor of St. Thomas's. In that font, I was christened. At that rail, confirmed. In that pew, Hawleys have sat for God knows how long, and that's no figure of speech. I must have been deeply printed with the sacredness, because I remember every desecration, and there were plenty of them. I think I can go to every place where my initials are scratched with a nail. When Danny Taylor and I punched the letters of a singularly dirty word with a pin in the Book of Common Prayer, Mr. Wheeler caught us, and we were punished, but they had to go through all the prayer books and the hymnals to make sure there weren't more. Once, in that chair stall under the lectern, a dreadful thing happened. I wore the lace and carried the cross and sang a beefy soprano. Once the bishop was officiating, a nice old man, hairless as a boiled onion, but to me glowing with rays of holiness. So it was that, stunned with inspiration, I set the cross on its socket at the end of the processional and forgot to throw the brass latch that held it in. At the reading of the second lesson, I saw with horror the heavy brass cross sway and crash on that holy, hairless head. The bishop went down like a pole-axed cow, and I lost the lace to a boy who couldn't sing as well, a boy named Skunkfoot Hill. He's an anthropologist now, somewhere in the West. The incident seemed to prove to me that intentions, good or bad, are not enough. There's luck, or fate, or something else that takes over accidents. We sat the service through, and heard the news announced that Christ was risen indeed. It ran shivers up my spine, as always. I took communion with a good heart. Alan and Mary Ellen weren't yet confirmed, and they got pretty restless and had to be given the iron eye to stop their jittering. When Mary's eyes are hostile, they can pierce even the armor plate of adolescence. Then, in the drenching sunshine, we shook hands and greeted and shook hands and wished the season's best to the community of our neighbors. All those we'd spoken to coming in, we re-greeted going out. A continuation of the litany, of a continuous litany in the form of decorous good manners, a quiet supplication to be noticed and to be respected. Good morning, and how are you this fine day?
Very well, thank you. How is your mother?
She's getting old, the aches and daggers of getting old. I'll tell her you asked for her. The words are meaningless, except in terms of feeling. Does anyone act as the result of thought? Or does feeling stimulate action, and sometimes thought implement it? Ahead of our small parade in the sun went Mr. Baker, avoiding stepping on cracks. His mother, dead these 20 years, was safe from a broken back. And Mrs. Baker, Amelia, tripping along beside him, trying to match his uneven stride with her fluttering feet, a small bright-eyed bird of a woman, but a seed-eating bird. Alan, my son, walked beside his sister, but each of them tried to give the impression that they were total strangers. I think she despises him, and he detests her. This may last all their lives while they learn to conceal it in a rose cloud of loving words. Give them their lunches, my sister, my wife,
their hard-boiled eggs and pickles, their jelly and peanut butter sandwiches, their red barrel-smelling apples, and turn them free in the world to spawn. And that's just what she did. They walked away carrying their paper bags, each one to a separate, private world.
Did you enjoy the service, my darling?
Oh, yes, I always do. But you, sometimes I wonder if you believe. No, I mean it. Well, your jokes, sometimes.
Pull up your chair, my dipsy darling. I have to get lunch on.
Bugger lunch. That's what I mean. Your jokes.
Lunch is not sacred. If it were warmer, I could carry you to a rowboat, and we would go out past the breakwater and fish for porgies.
We're going to the baker's. Do you know whether you believe in the church or not, Ethan? Why do you call me silly names? You hardly ever use my name.
To avoid being repetitious and tiresome. But in my heart, your name rings like a bell. Do I believe? What a question. Do I lift out each shining phrase from the Nicene Creed, loaded like a shotgun shell, and inspect it? No, it isn't necessary. It's a singular thing, Mary. If my mind and soul and body were as dry of faith as a navy bean, the words, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures," would still make my stomach turn over and put a flutter in my chest and light a fire in my brain.
I don't understand.
Good girl. Neither do I. Let's say that when I was a little baby, and all my bones soft and malleable, I was put in a small Episcopal cruciform box, and so took my shape. Then, when I broke out of the box, the way a baby chick escapes an egg, is it strange that I had the shape of a cross? Have you ever noticed that chickens are roughly egg-shaped?
You say such dreadful things, even to the children.
And they to me. Ellen only last night asked, "Daddy, when will we be rich?" But I did not say to her what I know. We will be rich soon, and you who handle poverty badly will handle riches equally badly. And that is true. In poverty she is envious. In riches, she may be a snob. Money does not change the sickness, only the symptoms.
You talk this way about your own children. What must you say of me?
I say you are a blessing, a dearling, the brightness in a foggy life.
You sound drunk. Anyway, intoxicated.
I am.
You aren't. I could smell it.
You are smelling it, sweetheart.
What's come over you?
Ah, you do know, don't you? A change. A bloody big storm of a change. You are only feeling the outmost waves.
You worry me, Ethan. You really do. You're wild.
Do you remember my decorations?
Your medals from the war?
They were awarded for wildness, for wilderness. No man on earth ever had less murder in his heart than I. But they made another box and crammed me in it. The times, the moment, demanded that I slaughter human beings, and I did.
That was wartime and for your country.
It's always some kind of time. So far I've avoided my own time. I was a goddamn good soldier, Potkin. Clever and quick and merciless. An effective unit for wartime. Maybe I could be an equally efficient unit in this time.
You're trying to tell me something.
Sadly enough, I am. And it sounds in my ears like an apology. I hope it is not.
I'm going to set out lunch.
Not hungry after that nor'easter of a breakfast.
Well, you can nibble something. Did you see Mrs. Baker's hat? She must have got it in New York.
What has she done with her hair?
You notice that? It's almost strawberry.
To be a light, to lighten the Gentiles, and to be the glory of thy people, Israel.
Why would Margie want to go to Montauk this time of year?
She loves the early morning.
She's not an early riser. I joke with her about that. And don't you think it was queer Marullo bringing candy eggs.
Do you connect the two events? Margie gets up early and Marullo brings eggs?
Don't be silly.
I'm not. For once, I'm not. If I tell you a secret, will you promise not to tell?
It's a joke.
No.
Well, I promise.
I think Marullo is going to make a trip to Italy.
How do you know? Did he tell you?
Not exactly. I put things together. I put things together.
But that'll leave you alone in the store. You'll have to get someone to help you.
I can handle it.
You practically do everything now. You'll have to get someone in to help.
Remember, it isn't sure, and it's a secret.
Oh, I never forget a promise.
But you'll hint.
Ethan, I will not.
Do you know what you are? A dear little baby rabbit with flowers on your head.
You help yourself in the kitchen. I'm going to freshen up.
When she was gone, I sprawled out in my chair and heard in my secret ears, Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word. And darned if I didn't go to sleep. Dropped off a cliff into the dark, right there in the living room. I don't do that often. And because I'd been thinking of Danny Taylor, I dreamed of Danny Taylor. We were not small or great, but grown, and we were at the flat, dry lake bottom with the old house foundations and cellar hole. And it was early summer, for I remarked the fatness of the leaves, and the grass so heavy that it bent of its weight. The kind of day that makes you feel fat, and crazy too. Danny went behind a young juniper, straight and slender as a column. I heard his voice, distorted and thick, like words spoken underwater. Then I was with him, and he was melting and running down over his frame. With my palms, I tried to smooth him upward, back in place, the way you try to smooth wet cement when it runs out of the form, but I couldn't. His essence ran between my fingers. They say a dream is a moment. This one went on, and the more I tried, the more he melted. When Mary awakened me, I was panting with effort.
Spring fever, she said. That's the first sign. When I was a growing girl, I slept so much my mother sent for Dr. Grady. She thought I had sleeping sickness, but I was only growing in the spring.
I had a daymare. I wouldn't wish a dream like that on anyone.
It's all the confusion. Go up and comb your hair and wash your face. You look tired, dear. Are you all right? It's nearly time to go. You slept 2 hours. You must have needed it. I wish I knew what was on Mr. Baker's mind.
You will, darling. And promise me you will listen to every word.
But he might want a word alone with you. Businessmen don't like ladies listening.
Well, he can't have it that way. I want you there.
You know I have no experience in business.
I know. But it's your money he'll be talking about. You can't know people like the Bakers unless you are born knowing them. Acquaintance, even friendship, is a different matter. I know them because Hawleys and Bakers were alike in blood, place of origin, experience, and past fortune. This makes for a kind of nucleus, walled and moated against outsiders. When my father lost our money, I was not edged completely out. I'm still acceptable as a Hawley to Bakers for perhaps my lifetime, because they feel related to me. But I'm a poor relation. Gentry without money gradually cease to be gentry. Without money, Alan, my son, will not know the Bakers, and his son will be an outsider, no matter what his name and antecedents. We have become ranchers without land, commanders without troops, horsemen on foot. We can't survive. Perhaps that is one reason why the change was taking place in me. I do not want, have never wanted, money for itself. But money is necessary to keep my place in a category I am used to and comfortable in. All this must have worked itself out in the dark place below my thinking level. It emerged not as a thought, but as a conviction.
"Good afternoon," Mrs. Baker said. "So glad you could come. You've neglected us, Mary. Hasn't it been a glorious day?"